Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today became a spokesperson for a generation with his six-book series Tales of the City, chronicling life and popular culture in San Francisco. His writing changed the way we live, making us laugh along the way. His campaigning has made him a gay icon, and the astonishing Letter to Mama is an exquisite piece of heartfelt poetry which has comforted and given strength to many. His memoir, Logical Family, has just been published. Armistead Maupin, thank you so much for coming in.
Lovely to be here.
What is a logical family?
Logical family is a phrase I coined about 10 years ago for my novel, Michael Tolliver Lives. Mrs. Madrigal, the landlady, is comforting one of her tenants who's having trouble with his arch-conservative family back in Florida. And she says to him, well, my dear, you have your biological family, and then you have your logical family. So what I'm meaning by it, of course, is it's the family that makes sense for you, the family that you have formed yourself, where it's not dictated by blood. Sometimes, of course, your biological family can be part of your logical family. I'm lucky enough to have a few of those myself, but not always. And there are things about the way you live your life that your family doesn't approve of. And I'm not just talking about gay, which applies to me, but a lot of women find this as well. If they're living their lives exactly the way they want to live their lives, their parents don't approve. So it was my way of saying, make your own family and choose it carefully.
In your lovely memoir, Logical Family, you have the line, lone gazelles lost among the buffalo herds of our closest kin.
Yeah, we do feel that way growing up. A lot of queer kids feel that way growing up because there's nothing to unite you with the other people in your family. When you think about it, African-American kids at least have race in common with their parents, you know, something that can bond them. When you're a little queer kid, you're not playing by the rules at all, or, you know, a little trans kid. And that makes you feel very lonely when you're growing up. You feel disconnected from the world, from everything else. You often turn inward, develop a good fantasy life. I think that's why a few writers get made that way. But it's not the easiest thing in the world. But in its own way, it's a blessing. I am really happy being a lone gazelle these days.
Tell me about your buffalo herd, though. Tell me about your family.
My buffalo herd. Well, my mother and father are both gone. My mother died 40 years ago. My father died 10 years ago. I deal with both things in Logical Family. I'm left with my sister, who lives out in Portland on the West Coast, and feels roughly the way I do about the world. And my brother, who is a Trump supporter and an arch-conservative and someone who got upset when they said that the Confederate monument had to come down on Capitol Square in Raleigh. He's very old school.
And, of course, that comes really after your father, who was very much like that himself. And,
in fact,
you were like that, too, at the beginning.
I was. I think when both my brother and I decided to copy my father to gain his affection, I did it early on and discarded it because I realized that my own life was dictated something else. My brother, I think, realized that it gave him a place in the world to continue my father's legacy.
That feeling of otherness, of not connecting perhaps with those views and, of course, with your sexuality being a secret at that time, as you say, created a space for you to start exploring your writing. You talk about building my manly armor with words. I suppose hiding who you were with what you were writing initially.
If you're trying to hide that you're gay, there's another place in there where I say, a leer is as good as a lie, meaning if you comment on some woman in front of another man, much the way that President Trump did with Billy Bush, make some sexist, awful remark about a woman, it sort of gives you cred as heterosexual. And I know a lot of men that did that early on in their lives before they came out.
Your mother, though, seems to have been a wonderful influence, somebody who was really trying to do the best for you in every possible way, from controlling your adolescent acne to making you walk like a pigeon and not like a duck.
She was deeply concerned that I not be mocked And in the end, I had to really get firm with her and tell her that I was very happy the way I was and not stop fretting about it. That was mostly what concerned her when I came out to her, was how it was going to affect my career. And I finally just said, "Mummy, you don't understand. It is my career."
Because, of course, homosexuality at the time was an unspeakable crime against nature in the state of North Carolina.
Which left it very open as a career opportunity.
As you say, it turned out to be the inspiration for your life's work. And I wonder how that realization came about. I mean, I know that by sort of chapter six, I, and I'm sure every other reader, is screaming for you to lose your virginity.
I'm glad they are. at that point, by the time I couldn't let it wait any longer in the book. I had to make it happen. Yeah, I call myself a bargain bin of overripe fruit that had passed its sell-by date.
It's a fantastic phrase. You tell the whole experience so beautifully. And it's not the love story that the reader longs for, but it's certainly cathartic, isn't it?
It's funny. I tried that story out on stage in Provincetown, which is a big gay resort in Massachusetts, out on the tip of Cape Cod. For 6 years in a row, I went to Bear Week, which is bears are the big, burly gay guys. And they make a great audience because they get a little drunk beforehand and they laugh very hard. And so I told them the whole coming out story and tried it on stage before I actually put it on the page. And much of the book was developed that way. I could see where the laughs would come in and where the somber moments arose. And it completely conformed with the way I like to write, which is to speak in my own voice. I've always wanted my voice to be heard from the page.
Of course, you started writing before this, can we call it a seminal event, and you were...
yes, you can, actually. That's about all it was.
Your first column was in the Daily Tar Heel. Now, of course, this is when you were at college, and one of the questions you ask yourself in the book is, who is Armistead Maupin Jr.?
You'd have a hard time recognizing me back there because I was very conservative. I think I received a lot of awards at the University of North Carolina because I was the only vocal conservative on campus. This was a major university in the 60s, so people were thinking entirely the other way. But I was trying my best to be my father's son, to express conservative views, to rail against the communists and the socialists in the National Student Association, and silly, really, when I look at it now. Very, very silly.
But you say that art seeped into your rational consciousness in the way that rational thought couldn't.
I was referring to Joan Baez. And a lot of the pop and folk singers of the day were teaching me things simply by touching me with their music.
Mm. And making you realize you weren't this deeply conservative person that you really so badly at that time appeared to want to be.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And later on, of course, in the memoir, Joan Baez comes back in person in a crucial moment in my life.
In a very moving moment, which we'll get on to. Let's talk about sex, because that's always a good thing. Once your sex life's up and running, and it's very active once you discover how to do it, how to find people and all the rest of it, you get crabs. And I love the idea of whether crabs can be straight or gay.
I really worried about that because I was in the Navy at the time. And I discovered these little critters crawling around on me. And it would shock me. That in itself was shocking because I thought they were some sort of a rash. I had heard my men referred to skivvy crickets, but I had no idea that it was this actual living creature that was inhabiting your body. Because I was afraid that if I went to the medical officer with whom I dined every day in the officer's wardroom, that he would immediately realize that my crabs were gay crabs and not straight crabs. And so I tried to do my own treatment, which was to pour Menin's skin bracer on the affected area. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with that in Britain. Menin's skin bracer is this green, almost totally alcohol, mentholated thing. And it burned me radically. And the crabs just got drunk, you know. And so I finally found a corner store that was far enough away from where I live that I could go buy some over-the-counter medicine.
Now, as you say, you were in the Navy at that time, so you served in Vietnam and you went to Cambodia. And in fact, you went to some efforts to be the last man out of Cambodia.
I did. I didn't know I had a shot at the title, but I was on a little boat up the river, 27 miles up the river into Cambodia, which was the limit. That was as far as you could go. And we were mostly a communications post. But one day we heard from a correspondent from ABC News who said that our boat was going to be the last one to withdraw from Cambodia, and they'd like to film us doing it. And so there was great excitement on the boat because everybody could get dressed up in John Wayne clothes and pose as the ship pulled out. Well, as it happened, I had pulled the radio watch duty, and that was down below. And I couldn't see anything and couldn't be seen. And I was very depressed about it until I figured out that when we crossed the border into Vietnam, that would be the moment of the withdrawal, and that whoever was on the fantail of the boat would be officially the last man to leave Cambodia. So I went back there to the fantail and started taking a shower, naked, soaping up on the fantail, and could see the flagpole where Vietnam began. And I realized when we cross there, I'll be able to tell everybody I was the last guy out of Cambodia. That a commander on the ship, the ranking officer on the ship, obviously had the same idea, and he was back there lurking around, waiting to claim the title for himself. So I went and climbed out onto the anchor winch, this piece of metal.
Still naked?
Still naked, still covered in soap suds. And for a moment, deathly afraid that I was going to fall to my death from the from that thing, and imagining the letter they would be writing to my parents saying, "Dear Mr. and Mrs. Maupin, your son died the way he would have wanted, naked and covered in soap suds and desperately seeking attention."
It's fantastic. It's a brilliant story.
And it's a true one, amazingly enough. I can't believe that I even wanted that so badly, but I did.
You say that you have theme music for all the moments of your life. So, for instance, meeting Kurt, one of your first loves, it was, you know, wah, 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 wah.
That oh, if. You can do that.
Absolutely. Bread, David
if
Gates.
David Gates and Bread, the carbonated song. Yeah. I talked about that on stage when telling that story and said, and quoted the, you can't use lyrics in books anyway because they charge you for them. But there was that line, "When my life, love for life is running dry, you come and pour yourself on me." Mm-hmm. And I said, that struck me as entirely appropriate since he'd done that at least twice.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And my very genteel editor said, I think you might want to just save that for the stage show.
What are some of the other big bits of music that have marked those
Well, you know,
moments?
When I was in London at 19, I remember walking around, and the theme music I picked, because you heard it everywhere, was the song Telstar. It was an instrumental called that thing. That one, and a song called I Like It.
Oh, terrible.
I like it. I like the way you run your fingers through my hair.
Yep.
That I thought that was very English. At the time. But I've always done it. I can conjure up all sorts of places and moments with songs.
Mm-hmm. I think we should really look at your work before this book, because, of course, you're known for Tales in the City. This came about as a column, but tell us how that column was initially sparked.
I was writing for a small Marin County newspaper, a local newspaper in the Bay Area, and trying to write a nonfiction piece about a very strange heterosexual mating ritual that was happening down at the Marina Safeway at the supermarket. On Wednesday nights, young women would go down there overdressed. In those days, that meant rhinestones on brushed denim, pantsuit kind of thing. And guys would go down there as well, and they would cruise the vegetable aisles, making conversations about vegetables, to pick each other up. And they knew to go there, to that specific spot. So I went down there and tried to write a story on it. Of course, nobody would admit to coming to the grocery store to get laid. So I went home and decided I was going to make up a new girl in town, and I named her Mary Ann Singleton. And I created a situation where she finally meets the man of her dreams in the vegetable aisle, and he's there with the man of his dreams. It struck a spark with a lot of single straight women in town who were discovering that not all the men that caught their eye were eligible. And that was the I did that for one episode, and then the editor of the newspaper said, "Why don't you follow her?" And I said, "Well, can I follow the gay man as well?" And he said, "Sure, just do what you want to do and just keep the story rolling." So I did about five episodes of that before that paper folded. But I took the idea to the Chronicle, a daily newspaper, and told them, far too much confidence, that I could do that on a daily basis forever. And that's how it started.
The people you seem to have brought together within your characters, Anna Madrigal, for instance, Mary Ann Singleton, Michael, they are all, it would seem to me, not one person that you've met in your life, but you've put a lot of people together. I was really, really interested in the character of Gordon Langley Hall, later Dawn Simmons.
Oh, in the memoir. Oh, yes. Well, Gordon Langley Hall was a real person in Charleston who wrote books about famous ladies, not very good books, I've heard, but paperbacks about Princess Margaret and Lady Bird Johnson. And he had grown up at Sissinghurst here in England, and I think his mother was a servant in the house. And he had befriended Whitney, a woman named one of the Whitneys in New York, and she'd left him some money. So he arrived in Charleston full of all sorts of airs and was embraced by Charleston society right up to the point that he came back from the gender identity clinic at Johns Hopkins University and began to live as a woman. He started wearing yellow Angora sweaters around town. And he'd been eccentric before then. I mean, people took note of the fact that his Great Danes wore pearls when he took them for a walk. I would like to have a Great Dane just to put some pearls on it. And he was promptly ostracized in a big way. And then he married an African-American auto mechanic in the ancestral home that he had bought. And they really didn't talk to him then. It was the first interracial marriage in South Carolina. The mystery of this person who was really very, very brave person was not fully solved for me until I read a book called Peninsula of Lies that answered the question that I wanted to answer. Was it possible for her to have a child because she showed up pushing a child around the battery? Could, if she had been born a man, could she have given birth to that child? All of that was on Charleston's mind. When Dawn Langley Hall died, actually Dawn Pepita Langley Hall, because that was a pet name at Sissinghurst, apparently. When she died, there was an obit in the New York Times, and it was largely composed of apologies from people in Charleston who said, "We treated her abominably."
Mm. She was one of the inspirations for the landlady, for Anna Madrigal.
I started getting ideas about that sort of thing.
You've said that Madrigal was one of your finest achievements.
She's certainly my most singular achievement. And I'm very proud of Anna Madrigal. She was, by most people's account, the first sympathetic transgendered character in literature. You might find Myra Breckinridge sympathetic. I don't. And she was an ordinary person. She was an ordinary person with a kind heart. And that made her a radical creation. The year I created her was the year that Bruce Jenner won Male Athlete of the Year, to put it in perspective.
Mm, and Bruce, of course, is now Caitlin.
Yeah.
The first time that Fitz Tales of the City, the column, came out was on May the 24th, 1976. And you describe what happened that night and who it was read by and this extraordinary kind of meta experience.
Yes, I still find it amazing, really. I had met Rock Hudson a couple of months before.
And of course, he was a huge movie star at the time.
Yeah.
But very much not publicly gay, not
right,
out.
Right, right. But widely known to be gay in California. Widely known, because he made no secret of it. And the night of the, before the column came out, I told him that I had this thing that was appearing in the Chronicle. I bragged to him that the story I was telling was about to appear in the paper. And he went down to the front desk at the Fairmont Hotel and bought the early edition of the Chronicle, came back to the suite where there were about 10 young men gathered after dinner, and said, I have a little reading I'd like to do. And he stood up and he read Tales of the City to the crowd. Now, that opening chapter of Tales is Marianne, the new girl in town, telling her mother she's not coming home. Her mother says, oh, you must come home. It's terrible there. I was just watching Macmillan and Wife, and there's a serial killer on the loose. And, of course, Macmillan and Wife was Rock Hudson's show. So here's Rock Hudson reading a reference to his TV show in front of me. I felt it was an amazing, amazing moment.
Later on, when he got ill, when he contracted HIV, you talked about him, and many people accused you of outing him.
Well, if you use that definition of it, I did. I knew that somebody needed to speak for him. People around him were idiots and old world protectors of the closet. I knew them very well, and I knew they didn't know how to deal with it. They lied for too long. They were saying he was on a watermelon diet or he had anorexia, and it was blazingly obvious what he had and how he got it and all of that. My friend Randy Schiltz, who wrote a book called And the Band Played On about the AIDS epidemic, called me up and said, we have to let this story live in the mainstream, meaning not in the tabloids, because that's where it was going rapidly. Would you be willing to talk about your friendship with Rock? So I said I would. And I said, yes, of course he was gay. A lot of people knew he was gay. He has nothing to be ashamed of. If anything, I feel terrible grief that he's lived his whole life having to maintain this secrecy for Hollywood, basically. And I got some criticism for it, yeah, from gay people in San Francisco who still were playing by the old rules of, oh, you don't talk about it ever. You don't talk about it unless they talk about it. Well, that's making up special rules for homosexuality that are different from heterosexuals. Mm-hmm. And it was clear to me that we didn't stop that. We weren't going to make any progress at all socially. And a lot of my friends were dying terrible deaths, and they had been public about AIDS and being gay. And I was angry. I was angry that we were still tiptoeing around the subject at a time when the truth was so important. So that's why I did it. And in the end, I did a good deed for Rock, too, because he got a lot of letters from people saying, don't be silly, we love you for who you are.
Of course, you were and still are a great campaigner and somebody who has given a voice to so many people. And alongside you, of course, and a great friend of yours, Harvey Milk.
Yes, well, I mean, I didn't give him his voice. We were doing the same thing at the same time, in the same place, interestingly. Harvey's assassination figures as a story in Logical Family.
And that what brings us back to Joan Baez, actually, because
oh, yes.
You then go to Harvey's memorial and your parents are in town but not expected to go to that.
No, and they suddenly appeared in the edge of the crowd. It was like a miracle. I couldn't believe they were there. I thought I'd drop them off at their hotel, and obviously they were just curious as to where we were going. And so they came down to the square there. And my father had hated Joan Baez since the days of the Vietnam War. And my mother said, "Who? That woman has a beautiful voice." She was up there singing Amazing Grace. And I said, "Well, it's Joan Baez." And she said, "Oh, no." And I said, "It's okay. What he doesn't know won't hurt him." She came back as a theme song at a time when I would never have expected her.
Of course, you were out from the minute you went to San Francisco, really, to everybody that lived there, and anybody that cared to read your column closely, I'm sure, would have realized that.
Yeah.
But your parents didn't particularly. But there was one piece of writing that you directed really straight at them.
Yes. In a way, it was cowardly, I suppose. I could have just called him on the phone and said this and this and this, but I wanted to get everything right. I wanted to put my finest effort into telling them how I felt about being gay and how I felt about them in regard to that, because so many parents do this thing of what did we do wrong? You know, how did we make him that way? And I wanted to just be very clear with them that I was in a very happy space. So I wrote a letter that I put in the words, I made it Michael Tolliver, my gay character, writing his parents.
It's become iconic, really, an iconic piece of literature, an iconic piece of gay literature. It's the letter, I think, that every gay child goes to. You can insert your own name in there and send it off to your parents, can't
you? Yeah, I heard that at the time, 40 years ago, and I still hear it, amazingly enough. And it's been set to music several times. Big choruses perform it. Ian McKellen and Stephen Fry have performed it in public places.
And in a way, it kind of sums up everything that this book and Tales of the City are about.
I suppose it does. It took me less than 45 minutes to write it. That's the odd part, because I'd been planning to say it for 15 years.
Would you read it to us?
Sure. Dear Mama, I'm sorry it's taken me so long to write. Every time I try to write to you and Papa, I realize I'm not saying the things that are in my heart. That would be okay if I loved you any less than I do, but you were still my parents, and I am still your child. I have friends who think I'm foolish to write this letter. I hope they're wrong. I hope their doubts are based on parents who loved and trusted them less than mine do. I hope especially that you'll see this as an act of love on my part, a sign of my continuing need to share my life with you. I wouldn't have written, I guess, if you hadn't told me about your involvement in the Save Our Children campaign. That, more than anything, made it clear that my responsibility was to tell you the truth, that your own child is homosexual, and that I never needed saving from anything except the cruel and ignorant piety of people like Anita Bryant. I'm sorry, Mama, not for what I am, but for how you must feel at this moment. I know what that feeling is, for I felt it for most of my life. Revulsion, shame, disbelief, rejection through fear of something I knew, even as a child, was as basic to my nature as the color of my eyes. No, Mama, I wasn't recruited. No seasoned homosexual ever served as my mentor. But you know what? I wish someone had. I wish someone older than me and wiser than the people in Orlando had taken me aside and said, "You're all right, kid. You can grow up to be a doctor or a teacher just like anyone else. You're not crazy or sick or evil. You can succeed and be happy and find peace with friends, all kinds of friends who don't give a damn who you go to bed with. Most of all, though, you can love and be loved without hating yourself for it." But no one ever said that to me, Mama. I had to find it out on my own with the help of the city that has become my home. I know this may be hard for you to believe, but San Francisco is full of men and women, both straight and gay, who don't consider sexuality in measuring the worth of another human being. These aren't radicals or weirdos, Mama. They are shop clerks and bankers and little old ladies and people who nod and smile at you when you meet them on the bus. Their attitude is neither patronizing nor pitying, and their message is so simple. Yes, you are a person. Yes, I like you. Yes, it's all right for you to like me too. I know what you must be thinking now. You're asking yourself, what did we do wrong? How did we let this happen? Which one of us made him that way? I can't answer that, Mama. In the long run, I guess I really don't care. All I know is this, if you and Papa are responsible for the way I am, then I thank you with all my heart, for it's the light and the joy of my life. I know I can't tell you what it is to be gay, but I can tell you what it's not. It's not hiding behind words, Mama, like family and decency and Christianity. It's not fearing your body or the pleasures that God made for it. It's not judging your neighbor except when he's crass or unkind. Being gay has taught me tolerance, compassion, and humility. It has shown me the limitless possibilities of living. It has given me people whose passion and kindness and sensitivity have provided a constant source of strength. It has brought me into the family of man, Mama, and I like it here. I like it. There's not much else I can say except I'm the same Michael you've always known. You just know me better now. I have never consciously done anything to hurt you. I never will. Please don't feel you have to answer this right away. It's enough for me to know that I no longer have to lie to the people who taught me to value the truth. Mary Ann sends her love. Everything is fine at 28 Barbary Lane. Your loving son, Michael.
Armistead Maupin, thank you so much. Logical Family is published by Doubleday. Armistead Maupin will be appearing live at the Theatre Royal in Brighton on the 28th of October. Head to the AG Tickets website for more details. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Sarah Miles and George McDonough. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.